Okay, so my name is Meg Pan Cook, and I'm here with Patrick, what's your name?
Cook.
Patrick Cook, to interview Kay Eccleston in Anaconda, Montana. The date is March 4th, 2011. So Kay, how about we just start, and you can tell me a little bit about yourself.
Okay, my full name is Catherine Stromberg Eccleston. I was born in Anaconda, 1953. I'm married to Carl Eccleston. We have two children, Eric and Kelsey. They're both married and have their own families. One lives in Ohio, the other in California. My mom and dad were both born in Anaconda, both children of immigrant parents. My father's parents came from Sweden. My mother's father came from Lettermore in Ireland. My grandmother was also 100% Irish, although her parents came from Boston. And interestingly enough, I've never been able to find a birth certificate for my grandmother, so I don't know if she was born in Boston or born in Deer Lodge County.
Your grandfather is from Ireland originally, is that what you said?
Yes. He emigrated when he was relatively young, in his teens at some point in time. It was after the turn of the century, so somewhere in the 1910s, 19-teens. He came from Lettermore, County Galway. It's an area that's now a designated Gaeltacht. And English was his second language, so he actually spoke Irish with his brothers here in Anaconda. My mom was always interested in learning a little snippet here and there of Irish, but when we were kids, she tried to teach us things like our prayers in Irish, and we would have nothing to do with it.
Did your grandmother, your mother, excuse me, did she grow up around a lot of Irish then being spoken around in the household?
Her father spoke Irish to the kids, and he would speak Irish to his brothers, and the folks that came from the general area in Ireland where he was from. But the story in the family was always that when the wives were around, they didn't speak much Irish. Mm-hmm. It was kind of their secret language.
That's funny. And your grandfather, did he immigrate with his brothers here to Montana?
The story that we were always told was that they came from a relatively large family. Mm-hmm. The father was a boatman. We don't know if that meant he owned his own boat, but it would have been very small. Mm-hmm. And they came from, at that time, a very poor area. And it was kind of a subsistence living. So he wasn't, there really was not enough work to support the number of boys in the family. So as soon as the kids were old enough, 14, 15, then they started making arrangements to join their mother's sister had emigrated to the United States, and she was the sponsor of all the children. One of his brothers died in Ireland in a drowning accident near the home, and another sister died very, very young as a child. But all of the other siblings in the family emigrated to the United States, and only one ever returned.
Do you know if your grandfather went back to visit at all, or did he never go back?
He never did. And actually, my grandfather was born somewhere close to a year before I was born. Hmm. And he did have a younger brother, Coleman. And Coleman was at least 10 years younger than my grandfather. Hmm. But we always looked to Coley as our surrogate grandfather. Mm. And it was kind of an interesting situation because my grandmother, Mary, and Michael Donahue were married here. Mary's younger sister, Julia, lived with them because her mother was a widow and she didn't get along with the stepfather. Mm. And then when Coleman came over, Michael's younger brother, Julia and Coleman were married. So my mom always talked about the fact that the two Donahue families were double cousins. Mm-hmm. So the two brothers married two sisters. So Coley adopted us. He treated us as grandchildren, and we looked to him as a grandfather.
When they moved over, you said that they came over to your, I guess it would be your grandfather's mother's sister.
Yes.
Where was she living at the time in the U.S., do you know?
It was a small town in Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh, and I have the name of it written down somewhere. It was Braddock, Pennsylvania. It was a very small enclave. And it was really interesting because an awful lot of people from the Lettermore area emigrated because they knew of friends or relatives that were working there. And then some of them ventured out to Montana when, you know, perhaps when times were tight at the steel mills and found work on the smelter. And so then they just kind of gradually came out here by word of mouth. But it was very interesting in that the area my grandfather was born is a very remote, sparsely populated, kind of a very close-knit little community. And then it was almost like they immigrated their entire community, first to Pennsylvania and then out to Montana. And it's interesting that if you ask someone from Dublin or a big city, well, what's the best way to get out to Lettermore? And they say, who goes? It's just so far flung. And you would hear the same thing if you say we're in Chicago and say, do you know the way to Anaconda, Montana? It's like, well, why would you want to go all the way out there? It's interesting that they both ended up in, or both communities kind of were in the same situation geographically.
And you think that was that kind of just a natural transition from them to go from the possibly like the steel mill in Pennsylvania to come out here and then work for the smelter here in Anaconda?
Yeah, it is kind of logical, but I think it had more to do with the fact that members of the community had emigrated and found work, and I think the work was incidental. They'd all been small holding agricultural folks or fishermen, but I think it was more trying to stay with the people that they were familiar with, their community, the communities kind of emigrated, as it were.
Where did your grandfather meet your grandmother?
He met my grandmother in Anaconda, because as I said, we're pretty certain my grandmother was born in Deer Lodge County. Her family lived on the outskirts of Anaconda, not in the city proper. I'm not exactly sure how or where they met, but Anaconda in those days was, it wasn't segregated as far as ethnicity goes, but there were lots of pockets of ethnic groups, and it was kind of unusual to socialize or marry outside those ethnic groups. So her father was an Irishman from Kerry, and so I don't know if my grandfather knew of him on the smelter and met his daughter. We really don't know. They talked very little about those types of things. And on the other hand, too, usually you only get interested in asking those questions after the people you should have asked are long gone.
Were there any stories that you heard from your parents about your grandfather working here in Anaconda?
Yeah, some, really interesting, every family thinks they're interesting little tidbits. My grandfather really liked dogs, and he had like a border collie. And the border collie went everywhere with him. And in addition to working on the smelter, he also had a couple of odd jobs around town, one of which was, I think the technical term is, he was the swamper at the Owl Bar, which means that after the bar closed, he would sweep the floors and clean up. And so he took the dog with him all the time. And my dad in particular used to tell the stories about Mike and his dog and the fact that the dog was treated like a person at the Owl Bar. They actually had a bar stool that the dog sat on. And the bartender was just as fond of the dog as my grandfather was. And if someone was sitting in the bar stool and the dog came into the barman would ask the patron to get off the bar stool and let the dog sit on the bar stool.
Oh, wow. Your grandfather was a swamper at a bar. What did he have any other jobs? Did he work at the smelter? Or?
He did work at the smelter, but I'm not exactly sure what the capacity was. I'm not really sure. And you know, unfortunately, like I said, you always think of the things you should have asked. The only person who would have known died last June, and it's just one of those things. Was my mother's brother, and you know, he'd share a few things, but he was about as closed mouth as the stories I heard about my grandfather. You know, they came from a very rural area that was really economically deprived. And my grandfather, my adopted grandfather, Coleman Donahue, the few things that he would say about it is people would ask him if he ever wanted to go back, and he'd always say, why on earth would I ever go back there? And if he was asked to describe it, all he would say is it was a terrible, rocky place. And the first time that I went there, I mean, I thought the landscape was beautiful, but it is a lot of limestone rock. You know, a lot of the fields were built up because they supplemented them with, they carried in seaweed and all kinds of other things to make the ground better. But it is very sparse, a very sparse and spare landscape.
When did you go visit
Ireland? I've gone to Ireland twice. I want to say that I think, I'm not positive, but I think the first time we went was in 1999 or 2000. And then when my daughter graduated, she did her PhD work in the UK. And so when she graduated, we went back again, met our son, and we visited with Kelsey in Scotland, and then we spent a week in Ireland. And we went out to the area where my grandfather was from both times.
How was that experience going and visiting where your grandfather was from?
Actually, it was really interesting. One thing about coming from a really small community like Anaconda is it's always surprising when you go someplace, like to the big city, and you hear so many times that somebody ran into somebody who knew somebody from Butte, or ran into, you know, they were in someplace in New York City or Chicago or something. And we had a really interesting experience like that. My grandfather had one sister who emigrated, married a gentleman. I want to say that the husband's name was Smith, but I'm not positive. But he died, and she returned to Ireland. And all we ever knew after we started getting interested in asking questions about whatever happened to her, well, she went back to Ireland and she married a man named Kelly. So I was like, there are a lot of Kellys in Ireland, I'm sure. And so the second time we went to Ireland, we stayed at an Irish-speaking B&B very near where my grandfather was from. And, you know, the woman just was very friendly, and she wanted to know, you know, why on earth did you come all the way out here? And so we told her, and she said, and what was the family name? And I said, Donahue. And she said, you know, let me make a phone call. So she made a few phone calls, and we met a woman named Kate Donahue, who was kind of a distant cousin. And she said, you know, well, what do you know? And I said, well, basically they all emigrated to the United States, but we do know that a sister came back, a sister named Margaret, and she married a man named Kelly. And she said, oh, let me make a phone call. So she took us out to this young man's house. His name was Kelly, but I think, I don't know if it was his father or grandfather, had a little bachelor room there. He was actually the nephew of the man that this aunt had married.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the really interesting thing is my my uncle Coley. Should we stop?
Yeah, if you want. That's
okay. Okay.
Great piece of documentary footage right there. the same thing happened at Celine's.
Oh, okay.
It was awesome. The husband looked in from the side. Oh.
So are we live again?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
No way.
I kind of lost my train of thought.
Oh,
you
know, actually, sorry, while we're paused, our
and I remembered where we were. So we went out and met this gentleman, and his name was Petey Kelly. And it was really interesting because my great uncle Coley smoked like a chimney. And we went out to visit Petey Kelly, and we were taken into his little bachelor room, and the man sat in the chair and chain smoked the whole time. But it was very interesting that my uncle Coley had a pretty thick accent. I was very used to it. My husband, Carl, on the other hand, there were many times when he would say, what did he say? And Petey Kelly's speech patterns were so much like Coley's. And Coley had a couple of expressions. And one thing that he would always like point his finger at you and say, oh, now I have you, now I have you. And so Petey Kelly said, so tell me who your people were, et cetera, et cetera. So I told him about this aunt and the brothers, and all of a sudden he started wagging his finger at me and said, oh, now I have you, mm-hmm. now I have you. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of interesting, that just something like a little phrase like that was something that was kind of a remnant that of a speech pattern or something that he grew up with. And so that was just... I just thought that was really special.
So you grew up here in Anaconda.
I did.
What kind of like childhood memories could you tell me about here?
It's one of those things that, you know, looking back and looking at the way things are now, mm-hmm. we were really blessed mm-hmm. to grow up in a small town where everyone knew everyone else. I went to parochial schools. First grade through high school. At that point in time in Anaconda, the population in Anaconda was large enough that it supported 3 parochial schools, and I'm not sure how many public schools. And there were always kids in the neighborhoods. I mean, no one ever, if you had to stay inside, that was, you were either sick or you were being punished. Mm-hmm. There were just tons of kids down on the school playgrounds. It was really nice to be able to go out, you know, just walk out to Washoe Park. My sisters and cousins and I would go out to Washoe Park and spend the entire day. We always knew when to go home because when the smelter whistle blew at 4 o'clock, you knew that supper was about to begin. So that was kind of our alarm clock. If you walk through Anaconda now, the population is much lower, mostly because of the loss of industry, and naturally, you know, there are not the number of large families that there were when I was growing up, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s. But it's so rare now to see packs of kids playing outside. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that I think is something that is remarkable about my childhood. It's what used to be normal, mm-hmm. And that's not so much anymore.
So just for my kind of clarification, what exactly is a parochial school?
A Catholic grade
Catholic
school.
Grade
yeah,
school.
The
okay.
we had the majority of the teachers were nuns, although we had some lay teachers, and the high school as well. There was an order of nuns that taught at the high school. Some of the teachers were priests, and there were some lay teachers as well.
Do you have any kind of distinct memories of going to Catholic school at all, or was it just kind of normal?
We thought it was normal.
Yeah.
Other people might not think so. It was really interesting in that the schools, rather than say going, you know, having all the primary school or primary grades first through third or first through fifth in one school and then a junior high, all of the parochial schools in town were first grade through eighth grade. So it was very much a kind of a family oriented pecking order almost. The eighth graders were the lower grades looked to the eighth graders as kind of the adults mm-hmm. of the school. Mm-hmm. It was Anaconda. I guess as I said, Anaconda had a really large population. The nuns had absolutely no difficulty as far as discipline went in the classroom. And on the other hand, though, it wasn't unusual to have 45 to 50 kids in a single classroom. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anyone attempting to teach a grade school class of that size anymore. But it was very interesting. You know, so our teachers, rather than being, you know, Mrs. Caney or Mrs. McCarthy, were Sister Anselm and Sister Everhard. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in seventh grade, probably sixth and seventh grade, the nuns all got to change their names. They all got to take back their real names instead of their nun names. So we left seventh grade and with one set of nuns and came back, and suddenly There was a Sister Jessica. Who's Sister Jessica? No one knew Sister Jessica. And that was her real name and not her... I'm not sure. They probably had a name for it, but I can't remember their order name or whatever it was. Yeah.
So when exactly? It was in the 80s, right, that the smelter closed?
It was. I want to say that the smelter closed in... The announcement came in 1980.
Okay.
On my mother's birthday. She took it particularly personally.
What do you remember about that time? Was that... that's something that stuck out for you?
Yeah, it's people kind of look back on those historic dates, and it's always, you know, where were you when Kennedy was assassinated or whatnot? I know where I was when Kennedy was assassinated. I was standing on the sidewalk along with all the other grade school kids from St. Paul's School, because we were lining the streets because the parish priest had died.
Mm.
So we were all kind of attending Father Schulte's funeral on the day that Kennedy was assassinated.
Wow.
Yeah. But the day the smelter, in fact, even in the interviews I've conducted with people that are, you know, considerably older than I am, that's, you know, that it's just something that for Anaconda was a very devastating time. Most people just thought, oh, you know, it's just another scare tactic. And probably 2 years later, they were thinking, oh, you know, we just have to wait a little while. It'll open up again. So it caused a lot of changes in Anaconda, because, you know, after the first year, then people who had young families to support, you know, they had to go elsewhere for work. So it was almost like that kind of history repeating itself. Our parents came from Ireland because of tough economic times, and then we kind of found ourselves in the same situation. Anaconda, like Ireland, was a place where our largest export was our young people, young families. Carl and I were fortunate enough in being able to stay. Carl didn't work for the Anaconda Company, and so just kind of by luck of the draw, you know, we got to stay. A lot of our friends had to leave. And, you know, a lot of people left anyway. You know, people go out after college or high school for, you know, the bright lights in the big city, or just a change of pace, or they're interested in something. But particularly Anaconda and Butte, I know that the people that were born there, it's always, you know, I wish my kids could have the childhood I did, or they seem to have particularly fond memories of the area. And, you know, one thing that was kind of interesting is probably 5 or 6 years after the smelter closed, you know, a lot of homes were for sale and times were still kind of tight. But it was interesting in that people who had grown up here, who were like early retirees, started moving back. And so that was kind of interesting, kind of a little mini renaissance.
Interesting. Do you think the smelter closing changed or made your kids' childhood much different from yours? What kind of impact do you think that had?
You know, I don't think so, because, like I said, we still had a small town.
Mm-hmm.
They still had the same kinds of circles of friends that I did when I was growing up. They were, because, as I said, much smaller families, so their circles of friends were much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But we were fortunate enough that we didn't. Our livelihoods weren't dependent on the smelter, and we were able to, you know, we had a modest house, kind of a modest lifestyle, and so I don't think that my children's childhood was that much different. It was a smaller scale, maybe.
Okay. Let's see. You mentioned to me earlier in our pre-interview that you are you're a member of the Ladies AOH.
I am.
Could you explain that for me just a little bit? What kind of that entails and stuff, being
okay.
a member?
The Ladies Ancient Order of Hibernians is started out as an auxiliary to the men's organization, the Ancient Order of Hibernians. Before that happened, they were actually a group called the Daughters of Erin.
Mm-hmm.
And they functioned primarily to serve as kind of a social network for young single women who emigrated from Ireland. They actually kind of, in some cases, sponsored, you know, they would be women who came from families who might have had relatives that they were sponsoring as far as the immigration process goes. Just kind of a social network, kind of a family away from the family that they left. I'm not exactly, and that's just stuff I've been told. I'm not exactly sure then when, you know, kind of coming under the umbrella of the Ancient Order of Hibernians happened. And then before I joined the organization, which was, I've been a member a very long time. Mm-hmm. I joined like in 1977. My mm-hmm. mother talked me into it. Mm-hmm. I was a little resistant. But at that point in time, they were a separate entity. They had kind of not broken away from the AOH, but rather than being a ladies' auxiliary, mm-hmm. they became their own mm-hmm. entity. And it's primarily I guess you would call it a service club now. You know, much like the Kiwanis or something like that. We do a lot of interesting projects. We have a quilt project every year. All of the ladies in the group donate squares for a quilt, and then we have a sewing committee that puts it together, mm-hmm. and then we sell all kinds of raffle tickets on it, and on St. Patrick's Day mm-hmm. we raffle off the quilt, and the proceeds go to a community entity. Oh, 1 year it was, you know, we've donated several times to the Washoe Theater because it's such a treasure for Anaconda. Mm-hmm. You know, they were, one year I think they lost their heating system. We've donated to Special Olympics, the Hearst Free Library. We just pick some local group or project or entity that needs a boost that year. And the past 3 years we've raised nearly $3,000 for these groups. So I guess now we are truly a service organization, but we also join it for the fellowship and the social aspect. You know, we have a Mother's Day dinner and a Christmas dinner and picnics throughout the year, and of course St. Patrick's Day. The ladies host the traditional breakfast for St. Patrick's Day. The both organizations attend Mass as a group on St. Patrick's Day, and then we have a breakfast, and at the end of breakfast then everyone in the room has to stand up and introduce themselves, and if you have a party piece you have to do your party piece. So if you're the person who always has a good joke, you have to tell a joke, or if you're the person who always sings a particular song, you have to sing the song. And unfortunately though, over the years we're to the point where, you know, some of those favorites have started to, you know, they're elderly people and they've started to pass from among us. So it's almost kind of a wistful thing. It's like, you know, remember on St. Patrick's Day when Sadie Murphy used to always do such and such, and you know, Sadie's no longer with us. Her daughter's still a member, but I don't want to say that, you know, we think we're better than Butte. We think that our St. Patrick's Day is a little bit maybe more more traditional. We don't have as much of the spring break aura that some St. Patrick's Day celebrations take on. Not that some of that doesn't go on, but it's really fun. We also, I think someone was talking about it last week, we also formed a drill team, the Irish Washerwomen Brigade. And 1 year it was really, really interesting in that we had a grandmother, a mother, and a daughter as far as our membership went. So I'm not exactly sure what our median age is, but at certain points in time, we've had 75-year-old washerwomen marching with the drill team. So that's really kind of fun. And you know, we have traditions that go with everything associated with the regalia for the parade, because the Irish washerwoman is kind of the archetype of, you know, an Irish woman who was able to take care of herself and her family. You know, some people think that, you know, the Irish washerwoman is kind of, oh, that's kind of a paddywhackery. It's kind of a joke. You know, the number of young Irish women, married and unmarried, who worked as domestics in the United States and helped raise families. You know, back in the 1800s and the 1900s and the early teens, it's, you know, long before there was, you know, equality in the job market between male and female, you know, our mothers were always working mothers. My mother always worked. Mm. So that wasn't something that, you know, instantly happened sometime in the 80s or 90s as a new trend. Mm. I think people who come from working class backgrounds know that you have to do what you have to do. And, you know, so I think it's an honor to working women. Mm. But we also have a lot of fun, too.
I'm sure. And you said your mother was also a member?
She was, yeah.
Was that probably kind of function kind of as like a social group like you were mentioning before? Do you remember any sort of events that she would do when you were younger with the AOH?
You know, the interesting thing was I think that my mother only... My grandfather actually was a member of the Anaconda Division AOH. Mm. And my mom always talked about the fact that she used to go to things that he went to. Mm. And he was always telling her she should join the auxiliary. But I think she just never did. And then friends of hers finally convinced her that, you know, after all these years, you really should join. And I want to say that it was probably... after I was in high school, so it wasn't until, you know, it wasn't something that I remember her going to when I was young.
Okay.
You know, as far as like celebrating St. Patrick's Day when I was young, I'm not sure who used to do this, but someone used to actually have authentic shamrocks flown in. Someone knew someone who knew someone. And so the AOH always had these shamrock sprigs. So we always typically just wore a little thing mm-hmm. to school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like the, you know, dressing in neon green from head to toe. That, you know, that kind of stuff didn't happen. But mm-hmm. So I wish I could say that, oh yeah, I remember mm-hmm. my mom doing this, that, and the other. I'm probably a lot more active in the organization than my mom was, simply because it took a long time for her finally to decide to join.
Mm-hmm.
So, gotcha. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Let's see. Do you have any, I mean, not related to the AOH, I guess, any kind of memories of holidays or anything else like that that you guys kind of did regularly, like a family tradition?
Family tradition.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting you ask that because I had my great uncle Coley's oldest daughter died last month.
Mm-hmm.
And her daughter is very close to my age, and so we were talking about this, and we were talking about Christmas, and our family, both families, this is the double cousin situations mm-hmm. here, always had some really strange, well, we thought strange Christmas traditions, and so did our husbands once they married into the family, that the families always went to midnight mass on Christmas Eve, and then for whatever reason, they always had a fried chicken dinner for breakfast on Christmas Day. And when Mary Alice died, Colleen and I got to talking about this, and I said, you know, when I told Carl about that, he thought it was just extremely strange. And by the time Carl and I got married, my mom had, maybe it was just too much work. The fried chicken dinner for Christmas Day had kind of gone by the wayside. But Mary Alice's mother and father still did it. And Mary Alice and her husband, my cousin's parents, did it. And Colleen and her husband live in Boise now, and they still do it. And the big question was, where on earth did that ever come from? Was it an Anaconda thing? Was it an Irish thing? Was it a Donahue thing? We don't know. And the people who would have known are gone. So I don't think it's an Anaconda tradition, and I don't think it's an Irish tradition,
mm-hmm.
but it was a Donahue thing.
That's funny.
Yeah, my husband could not believe it.
That sounds great.
It does, Do you have any other strong childhood memories like that? Any other kind of traditions or holidays that you guys would always celebrate?
You know, I'm not. Primarily, Christmas, Thanksgiving. As I said, you know, St. Patrick's Day when I was growing up was kind of low key.
Did you ever do anything for St. Stephen's?
No. In fact, that was kind of, once you get interested in your Irish roots and you read about certain things or you hear certain songs, you know, like the Wren song and stuff, that was something that we didn't necessarily hear a lot about. Although, when I interviewed Mary Lachlan Young, her parents came from the Lettermore area where my grandfather came from, and she says that when they were young, her brothers, based on things that her father had talked about, they sang the Wren song, and they, you know, they had some things that they did, but so that was something not so much. Although the other thing that's kind of interesting, and I don't know if it has to do with the fact that they were from a very remote area or what, is that my grandmother, and I'm assuming my grandfather as well, and the other Donahues, were that generation. They were very superstitious people. I opened an umbrella one time in the house, and I had it sitting on the living room floor, and I was playing with dolls or something, and I thought that was really cool. I was kind of like sitting under the umbrella. My grandmother came through the door and just literally had a screaming fit. And I was kind of one of these shy, retiring kids. I was like, oh my, it just affected me very deeply. Oh, just I didn't know what I had done wrong. But she was very superstitious about things like that. Opening an umbrella in the house, you never put your shoes on the kitchen counter or the kitchen table. They used to talk an awful lot about the banshee. It was amazing.
What's the banshee? Sorry. I'm so excited.
There, and Patrick, you'd be interested in this because there's a really, it's kind of a Paddy Whackery-ish film, a Disney film, called Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Sounds fantastic.
And there's a point in there where the main character gets chased by the banshee, and it's some kind of a ghost. And sometimes some people refer to it as the ghost of a woman that appears, a harbinger of ill, you know, like someone's going, if you view the banshee, and sometimes people talk about it as being a woman ghost, or sometimes the ghost of a small animal, and that if you see it, someone's going to die.
Right.
Interestingly enough, you know, now that, although my grandfather spoke Irish and I knew very little of it, I'm kind of paying homage to him by attempting to learn it. Banshee literally means a woman spirit. And so in Darby O'Gill, I think it was a horse. It was the banshee took the form of a horse and kind of a woman with long white hair.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating.
But I remember my grandmother talking about her father claiming to have seen a banshee. So I just think they were, you know, how some communities are just more into superstition and extra, you know, those types of paranormal things. And but I have always thought that was kind of interesting. And I don't know if that has to do with they were so rural or if that area of Ireland happens to be, you know, more in tune to those cultural things. I really don't know.
Wow. Gosh. I guess that whole superstition thing is really interesting to me. But do you remember anything else that your grandmother would do? Like maybe any kind of like homeopathic things? Did she have anything like that that she would... do any weird stuff?
Not exactly, except she was very... Vicks was the cure-all for everything. So if we had a cold, she was always wanting to get like a tea towel and put Vicks on it and plaster it on your back. Or if you had a sore throat, she'd put Vicks on a flannel diaper and wrap it around your neck. She always smelled of Vicks, and so did we.
Oh, that's great. That's funny.
Yeah. So homeopathic, I mean, and it's kind of interesting that some people disparage Irish people for, you know, drinking too much. You know, that's kind of those negative connotations. But interestingly enough, if somebody had a really bad cold and they happened to be a kid, a weak tea with a little whiskey in it, or a hot toddy with lemon, that was kind of a home remedy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like it wasn't like you got it very often, and sometimes it's like, no, I don't, you know, but so that was a home remedy.
Mm-hmm. My father has the same thing. He's from the Midwest, and he always makes fun of his mom because that's what she would do.
Yeah, you know, and I, you know, sometimes, well, you stop and think about it. Let's say maybe home cold remedies, some of them are alcohol based, and it's like,
mm-hmm.
Hey.
When I was a kid, I had really bad lungs, and my mom would make me a hot toddy if I had a cold. And I don't know if that was an Irish thing or just what she had handy, but
yeah, yeah. So the occasional hot toddy, and the interesting thing is my grandmother never touched a drop of beer, whiskey, or wine in her entire 85 years.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody was really, that she'd be the first one to say, well, you know, maybe they just need a hot toddy and go to bed and sleep. But the Vicks was, the Vicks was, yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. The other thing, it wasn't exactly related to superstition, and it wasn't exactly a homeopathic remedy, but I never really knew what my grandfather looked like, because my grandmother only had two pictures of him. One was kind of an enlargement of a home snapshot, and you could tell it was a man, but he was drinking a cup of tea, so the teacup was obscuring most of his face.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was, is kind of a, it was an interesting picture, I thought, but he was sleeping. It was interesting. It was kind of a smaller picture, and I don't ever know what happened to it. He wasn't sleeping. It was a picture that someone took at his wake.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And apparently that was not unusual at all.
Mm. Huh.
So in retrospect, it's kind of like, ooh.
Yeah, a little creepy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I really didn't even know that until I was grown.
Mm.
You know, I might have been talking to an uncle or maybe my mom or someone, and I'd say, oh, you know, well, that, and we always, for some, and I, as I said, I never met him, but he was always referred to as Ada. My Uncle Coley, we called him Da, but when we were referring to my grandfather, we referred to him as Ada. And I was like, oh, you know that picture of Ada when he was sleeping? You know, that there was that, like, that white pillow and stuff. And he wasn't sleeping. That was a picture of him in his casket.
Mm.
But we didn't know that.
Yeah. Wow. Huh.
Yeah.
Do you know why he, or if he wanted to be called Ada, or if that was just kind of...
You know, I don't know. And I always, you know, it's always like, oh, later I kind of romanticized. I thought, oh, you know, maybe that's, it's some kind of a, maybe it's some kind of a Gaelic, Irish word or something. But I asked Terry about it one time, and he said, oh, no, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it was, you know how every once in a while, say a grandchild will call a grandparent something and that name kind of sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that was something that, you know, maybe my older sister had called him, or my mom's nephews and nieces, the older ones.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea where the name came from. Mm-hmm. And my mom always referred to her father, not as father or dad or da, but Ada. So I really don't know. Maybe it was a nickname that she and her siblings had for him. I really don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know of any other kind of, naming traditions in your family? Is there any sort of thing that's passed down?
Yes, and it's just so generic. Everyone is either Mary or John. In fact, there are so many Johns in our family that we have John Heinz and John Francis and JT, which stands for John Thomas.
Mm.
And then my mom marries a man of Swedish descent, and his name is John. My brother's name is John. It's really interesting. We heard one time that it was not uncommon for an Irish set of parents to name the first child, the first male child, after the father's father, and the first female child, you know, that was kind of like this pecking order. I'm not really sure. From my grandfather's birth certificate, I know that his father's name was John, and my mom's only brother's name was John, or the only surviving brother's name was John. So it is kind of interesting. So we've had to attach those qualifiers mm-hmm. to them so that we could tell who was who.
Huh, that's funny. So you mentioned that your father is of Swedish descent. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know how your parents met at all? Story.
You know, not really. My dad would have gone to public school, and my mom went to, I think she attended St. Peter's grade school. She attended St. Peter's High School. My dad graduated from Anaconda High. They met and married after school, or after they graduated from school. My mom was very young. My mom was 18 years old, but I'm not really sure how they met. I do know that my dad got along very well with her father, because you know, for a long time, even when I was in high school, if you would talk about such and such a friend or something from school, the first thing my grandmother would say is, "Are they Irish or not?" So it was very common to, you know, kind of, wasn't like you couldn't marry outside the clan, but you know, in a lot of ways, it was a little unusual. But I do know that my dad and his father-in-law got along very well. In fact, you know, to the point where some of the most interesting stories are things, "Oh yeah, well, your grandfather told me one time," and then, so it was a story from my dad, but it was something that my mom's father had told him. You know, and they kind of shared the same interests. They both liked to hunt. My dad wasn't much of a hunter, but they liked to fish, and so did my grandfather. So my dad got interested in tying flies, and so, you know, he'd always tie flies for his father-in-law, Mike, and so I think they were really good friends.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, man, I had a question. No, it's gone. So a lot of your father's stories were about your grandfather, your mom's father.
Yeah.
And they do you think they got along well? Did your grandfather or your father, did he work in the smelter as well?
Yeah, he did. My dad was a machinist, so he was on the smelter. There were kind of like two general classifications. You were either a smelterman or you belonged to the crafts. And the crafts were the carpenters and the electricians and the iron workers, etc. So my dad was a machinist.
Okay.
When we were kids, I never could understand why, when we had trouble with our cars, why couldn't my dad fix them? I didn't know that there was a difference between a machinist and a mechanic. But there was.
Does your dad have any close ties with the smelter? Did he work there until it closed, or did he?
He did. Mm-hmm. He was, I want to say that he was in the machinists union for probably, it was a very long time, you know, something like, you know, 35 years. Mm-hmm. And then he did accept an offer to be like a maintenance supervisor on the smelter. So at that point, then you left the union and became part of the management team. Mm-hmm. One thing one advantage for my dad was that when the smelter closed in 1980, he was still a number of years away from the minimum age for retirement. Mm-hmm. But because he was in a management capacity, he got to stay on a lot longer, because there were certain things that had to be done by management, you know, as part of the shutdown and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So between that and then they offered like early retirement for some of those people and some incentives. So although he retired at an age younger than 65, there was kind of an, you know, something, there was a stop gap that saw him through until, you know, he could get full Social Security plus his company retirement. And those individuals who were in the management side were really, really fortunate in that they had full health care coverage through their retirement.
Oh, wow.
So they didn't have to depend just like on Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So my dad, that was, you know, and those individuals who retired from the smelter who were in kind of that area, those people, did very, you know, they had a real comfortable retirement,
mm-hmm.
mostly because they had that real, that safety net of the full health insurance, and it was wonderful health insurance.
Mm-hmm. And so your father was able to stay here in Anaconda after it closed?
Yeah. And our family is very spread out age-wise.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned an older sister.
Mm-hmm.
My older sister is 12 years older than I am.
Oh, wow.
And my youngest brother is 12 years younger than I am.
Oh, wow.
So when when the smelter closed, my brother was still in school.
Mm.
In fact, my brother graduated from high school in 1983, so when the smelter closed, my brother was like a freshman in high school, so that was really good that my dad was in the position that he was, and able to, you know, still have a working wage retirement income.
Mm-hmm. And did he just stay with them then until he was retired, or did he?
Yeah,
he did. Okay.
Yeah, he stayed on past the closure because they had to kind of oversee certain
mm-hmm.
aspects of the shutdown. And that extended it long enough that then he was able to, you know, then they had some kind of it was like a severance package.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm very interested in, since you ended up growing up here and your parents, grew up here too, what was the house that you grew up in? What was that? Did your parents buy a house, or was it kind of like a house in the family, or?
It was a house in the family.
Okay.
When my grandfather Mike died, my grandmother was 52 years old,
mm-hmm.
and they were in the process of buying a house. It was a really modest house. In fact, it's just a couple of blocks over from this house. It was a small two-bedroom house, so it had two bedrooms, a bathroom, a living room, and a kitchen. My grandmother, you know, she was left without a pension of any kind, my mom and dad, I think they actually were purchasing a house because my sister was a small child, and they sold their house and bought my grandmother's house and moved in with her. So until I was, in fact, when I was in seventh grade, my dad took the roof off the house and built two more bedrooms. But up until that point, there was a point at which there was my mom and dad, my grandmother. My older sister actually had graduated high school and gone on to nursing school.
Mm-hmm.
But there was myself, my two younger sisters in a two-bedroom house.
Wow.
But my dad was a very handy man, and
mm-hmm.
he had a good group of friends, and it was like every year there was a project on one family or another's house, and so one year it was our turn and we got two new bedrooms upstairs.
Wow.
Yeah. And when they were finished, my brother had just been born, so at that point in time my sister and I each got our own bedrooms. We thought we were a-okay. But we didn't think that was normal for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew a lot of people when I was growing up, when I was in grade school, that was not unusual for the living room to be converted into a bedroom every night.
Mm-hmm.
And that's primarily, you know, we had, you know, everyone had like a sofa bed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we treated the living room also as a bedroom as well. The oldest daughter always got to sleep with mom, because my grandmother had her own bedroom, of course.
Mm.
So that was interesting.
Yeah.
And it was a really small house.
Mm-hmm.
But
Is it, and it's still
my dad and mom lived in that house all their married life. My dad lived almost 10 years after my mother died. He was fortunate enough, and he always felt himself blessed that he got to live in his own home. And after he died, we sold the house. And that was maybe 5 years ago.
How was that process, selling the house?
It was hard.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was just one of those things. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting. Then you have to kind of walk away from things like that, because it once was your house, but now someone else owns it, and it's not as well kept up. In fact, it's to the point where finally I just stopped driving down that street because I didn't want to look at it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it made me sad, but I thought my dad took such pride in the house, mm-hmm. and it's not receiving the same care that he showed toward it.
Yeah. That's hard. I have the same house that I grew up in that's now not ours anymore.
Yeah.
It's hard to look at.
It is. It really is. On the other hand, we lived in a very small house on Locust Street. I was telling Patrick, up until it was about 5 years ago. We bought this house and worked on it for a couple of years, and then suddenly I was without a job, so we put our house on the market and sold it within a week, and we had to move in here. But we sold our house to a guy who is just happy as a clam to have it and takes good care of it. So it's really nice to see that, you know, somebody's enjoying the house. We don't have any wistful memories about, you know, we don't weep every time we go by it because we love this house.
That's good.
Yeah.
So you are also an interviewer for The Gathering.
I am.
I don't know, can you tell me a little bit about that process, how that's kind of helped you or maybe changed your idea about what it means to be Irish or anything like that?
I think if anything, it has confirmed what I already knew. The fact that often, you know, you just get so busy anymore. You know, it's not like people have shorter attention spans. It's just people are pulled in so many directions, and I think a lot of it is, you know, you have to do so much more to make a living. You know, and your time gets more valuable, and I don't think people take enough time to sit down and really listen to what other people might have to say. I don't know how many times I have. It's one of the reasons why I was interested in becoming an interviewer for The Gathering. It's you don't know what you have until you don't have it anymore. It's like, if only I could ask certain questions of people. I just think it's just such a valuable project, because these personal stories are really, yeah, they are personal stories or they're family stories, but they're so connected with who we are as a community. One thing that I think is just really unique is the fact that I don't know a lot about where my grandmother's folks came from, other than it was County Kerry. But we know a lot more about my grandfather's area, mostly because he wasn't one of these folks that immigrated in famine times. He, you know, immigrated long after that. But the fact that he came from such a small, close-knit community and was supported by a very small, close-knit community of friends and family members, and came over to, you know, first to Pennsylvania and then out to Montana, and that Anaconda, in a lot of ways, has those little enclaves of close-knit, supportive, they're not just families, they're extended communities or extended families that form communities. I just think it's something that needs to be recorded so that it's not lost.
Mm-hmm. Has it kind of opened up your feelings about Anaconda and the community that you live in at all, or?
I think that it's really easy to be very critical of the place that you're from.
Mm-hmm.
You notice all its flaws,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's really. I think it's really a blessing to be able to stop and think for a minute. And, you know, I'm not one of these Pollyannas, the glass is half empty, the glass is half full. But really, if you stop and look with a critical eye, the fact that you might not have had a lot of monetary benefits or a lot of, say, the opportunities culturally and otherwise that you might have had if you lived in a metropolitan area. But there are just certain things that make you who you are, mm-hmm. that came from the fact that you came from a small town, a close-knit town, a community that, by and large, it was okay with our parents if we left the house at 8 o'clock in the morning and took a sack lunch and spent the entire day at Washoe Park.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, 7, 8 year olds, you'd be beside yourself
mm-hmm.
if your 8 year old went somewhere at 8 in the morning and didn't come back until 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
It would be so stressful, you wouldn't know what to do. And
mm-hmm.
so I think, you know, we were so lucky.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Let's see. Have you ever kind of encountered possibly like long lost relatives through this process, or anybody who had more information about your family through the interview process?
You know, not exactly through the interview process. And because I've known her before I interviewed her,
mm-hmm.
Mary Lachlan Young was one person who, she remembers my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
So in the pre-interview process, you know, we got to talk about a few things, kind of, you know, I was more interested in trying to prepare for what I was going to ask her about her family.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she just had some interesting little tidbits, and some are kind of comical. She told me that, oh yes, I remember Mike Donahue, and I remember him down at the AOH Hall on St. Patrick's Day, because they always had like a young people's dance in the big hall, whatever the big hall was, and then the more traditional stuff in the small hall with the older folks who played the piano and the accordions. And she said, and every St. Patrick's Day, Mike Donahue would start a fight with someone. So little things like that, you know, that's probably something my mother wouldn't have told me.
That's cool. Let's see. I guess I was a little bit interested in learning a little bit more of what you had to say or whatever about kind of the different communities that were here in Anaconda. I know that Butte had its definite, you know, different ethnic neighborhoods and stuff, and I was wondering if Anaconda had anything like that at all, or if it was more of kind of a people mixed up, I guess.
I, you know, and just kind of, you know, you look at these kind of remnants, you know, like say social organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Anaconda has had always had a really large and thriving Croatian community. You and I guess, and I'm not up on Eastern
mm-hmm.
European geopolitical situations,
mm-hmm.
but Yugoslavian and Croatian,
mm-hmm.
there were large enclaves. There were also there were some groups of French families of, you know, with French backgrounds,
mm-hmm.
Italians, huge numbers of Italian immigrants. People of Italian descent,
mm-hmm.
To the point where there are actually like subdivisions of Italian communities in Anaconda. There were the West End Italians and the East End Italians.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those had to do with the areas in Italy where they came from. There were. So probably. Oh, it's Scandinavian, Norwegian and Swedish. My dad's family were Swedish, but there were lots of Norwegian and Swedish immigrants in Anaconda. There was a like Sons of Norway group, you know, like a social network. You know, two or three large Lutheran parishes. Someone once described, really, that Anaconda is very similar to Butte in that regard, and that Anaconda and Butte, unlike, say, the typical western town that most people think about when they think of Montana,
mm-hmm.
that Butte and Anaconda more closely resembled little microcosms of cities like Chicago,
mm-hmm.
because they were more industrial,
mm-hmm.
urban. It, we might have been very small, but more of, you know, that kind of ethnic mix, you know, more so than, you know, say a close-knit rural community like, I don't know, Cut Bank or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Do you think it was probably that just kind of like the industry kind of pulled all these people together? Did it create more of like a close-knit community, or I don't know if you personally could recognize it, or if you heard other people, but could you like recognize the difference between the different international communities within Anaconda?
You know, I don't really think so. I guess my experience was it was really a melting pot,
mm-hmm.
Type situation, mm-hmm. But really. Even when I was in grade school, I mean, typically that was one of the first things that you were interested in knowing about someone.
Mm-hmm.
If a new kid, which was kind of rare, wasn't, and you know, now society's more mobile, so it's not unusual to have a whole batch of new faces in when you return to school in the fall. But
mm-hmm.
Anaconda had, you know, kind of a relatively, a new kid was kind of a novelty.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing you wanted to know was, okay, were they German or were they Irish or were they Swedish or, you know, what were they? So that was, interesting in that because I attended Catholic grades or a Catholic school system, you know, so maybe if you met them in a social setting, that might be the second question you'd ask, you know, what nationality were they and what religion were they?
Mm.
I mean, not that, I don't think that set up any barriers, which is something that was, it was just something everyone was always interested in,
mm-hmm.
you know, were you this or were you that?
That's interesting. I guess this is kind of more of a pointed question, but so when I think of like Butte and Anaconda, just from the very small amount of exposure I've had to them, I think of, you know, the Irish population, and I don't normally think of you know, Italians and Croatians being a big part, but I mean, apparently they were. Why do you think that might be, that the Irish have had such kind of a lasting impression on these areas?
I'd be willing to say that it is probably two things, and I mean, you know, this is just my view of it. One is just the sheer numbers, because, for example, when I was in grade school, probably 75% of the kids in any given classroom were of Irish descent.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is, I think that by and large, they were very active in the communities, particularly in either labor efforts, union efforts, or government. You know, politics at, you know, like the local level or state level. So, you know, that might be one reason. I really don't know. It's kind of hard to say.
Mm-hmm. That's a good answer. Thank you. let's see. I think that is kind of almost everything, but I do want to ask this last question.
Okay.
If you were to write a history of the Irish in Montana, what would you include for future generations?
That's a really hard question. It is. And in fact, I haven't actually gotten to, I don't actually ask that question in those same words when I've conducted the interviews. To tell you the truth, I've never even really thought about it.
Mm. Yeah, it's worded, it's difficult.
Yeah,
it is.
I think of it more in terms of what would you want? Okay, that is difficult to reword. What would you want future generations to know about the Irish? What's important to know about the Irish in Montana?
One thing that, and it's more of a more narrow, focused on my family point of view,
mm-hmm.
is that when I stop and think about the fact that my grandfather and all of his brothers, and at least two sisters, left a close-knit community. And what I'm, and I know nothing about their personal family life, other than it was probably very difficult. But I can't imagine my son at the age of 16 or 17 leaving the country full well knowing that they would never see their parents again.
Mm-hmm.
I just, to me, the courage.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think too, I mean, it was an economic necessity. You know, maybe the decision was not theirs. You have to, you know, you're faced with the fact that, you know, this family can only support so many people, and you have to leave. You know, in the case of, you know, for example, my great uncle, it's like, why would I ever think of going back there again? It's kind of interesting. I do know, though, that one thing that also that, I mean, and I think it must have been a kind of frightening in a way for them, because I know that they came over, and my grandfather, for example, joined the United States Army around the time of World War I when he was in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know for a fact at that point in time he did not have papers.
Mm-hmm.
He'd not gone through the legal immigration thing. I also know that he could not read or write.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that at I can't remember how I, maybe it was through something Ellen Crane had mentioned one time, that there was an effort to entice young immigrants, or they made an offer to young immigrant men to get them to enlist during World War I, that, you know, if you served, then they would waive the paperwork, and when you were discharged, you would be I'm not sure what they call it, naturalized.
Mm.
So I know that was the case for my grandfather. Luckily, he did not have to go overseas.
Mm.
And his younger brother, Coley, whom I've mentioned, my mom's uncle, actually came to Montana, and then he and his family moved out to Oregon, and he worked in the shipyards prior to World War II. And he had no papers. And he actually had to leave the country, get in touch with the Irish consulate, leave the country, and come back through Canada with the help of the Irish consulate in San Francisco. Because he was here illegally, and at that point in time, I think there was probably, you know, like some kind of regulations as far as working in the industry at that time. So I don't think any of those. And I don't think that I ever stopped and thought about how much courage those types of things took. And it wasn't exactly courage in that, okay, I'm going to steel myself and go do this. It's like they were just put in these situations and then they had to deal with them.
Mm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, that the character.
Mm.
And I think too often people get swept up in, like, the stereotype of the, you know, the Fighting Irishman mascot from Notre Dame. And stop, and they don't look past that to see the, you know, real human stories. So I don't know if that's a good answer to the question. That's my answer to the question.
Great answer to the question. I guess, cool. Where did your grandfather serve in the Army? Do you know where he was stationed?
I do not know. I have, and you know, when I put together those digital things that I send you,
mm-hmm.
it has, interestingly enough, he's got like one of those plain white military headstones.
Oh.
So it actually has the brigade. But I do know that he did not have to, my dad told me that he did not have to go overseas. And being as it was World War I, that's probably a really good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Cool. Yeah, good. Thank you.